Syria calls on the UN Security Council to immediately move to end Washington's acts of aggression and crimes against the war-torn country. The U.S. president says he will make an announcement on Monday regarding a report which found Saudi Crown Prince directly approved the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. And Myanmar's military fires the country's UN ambassador after he urged the world body to use any means necessary to reverse the recent coup in the Asian nation. Hello, everyone, and a very warm welcome to World News. Now, our top story is Syria has called on the UN Security Council to take measures to stop what it calls U.S. acts of aggression against the Arab country. In a letter addressed to the UN Secretary General and President of the Security Council, Syria's foreign ministry that has condemned the recent U.S. airstrikes on Iraqi anti-terror resistance groups on the Syrian border. The ministry warned such actions can easily escalate tensions in the region. U.S. attack also drew condemnation from Director of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, slammed the raid as an act of organized terrorism aimed at boosting Daesh terrorists. Shamkhani made the remarks during a meeting with visiting Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein. Political analyst John Bosnich joined us earlier, saying the U.S. president has proven he's not a more moderate politician than his predecessor only weeks into office.
Let's start things off first from where I'm sitting. I'm sitting here in New York City in the United States, where the people of America elected a president who they were told was a more moderate, more rational, and more responsible leader. Well, we've now had that proven wrong within barely a month of taking office, because he has taken an unprovoked act of war against a sovereign state on the other side of the planet. That's point one. So all of those voters were deceived, and I'm glad to see that there are people around the world who are not deceived by these tales. Then we talk about the legal situation. This act of war, this targeted attack on a foreign sovereign state, is not only a violation of U.S. law, it's a violation of international law, and thus the UN Security Council should be brought into play here. But unfortunately, we know that the United States exercises a veto there. And so, actually, justice is unattainable.
Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has highlighted his country's commitment to Iraq's stability, hailing Baghdad's constructive efforts to maintain security in the region. Zarif made the remarks during talks with Iraqi counterpart Fuad Hussein in Tehran. During that meeting, Hussein stressed that Baghdad will not allow anyone to exploit recent incidents in Iraq to damage ties with Tehran. He expressed his country's readiness to boost relations with Iran. Hussein also referred to negotiations about Iran's access to its financial resources in Iraq and stressed Baghdad's commitment to facilitate the process. The Iraqi official arrived in Tehran on Saturday and has met with a number of senior Iranian officials. And next, hashtag trending returns with social media reactions to U.S. airstrikes in Syria under the new U.S. administration of Joe Biden.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another hashtag trending with me, Ali Reza. Today, we'll be looking at the first military strike under the new U.S. administration through the lens of social media, as we always do. Stay with us. It took Joe Biden a little over a month to really get into presidential form and act as a true American leader. He just ordered his first airstrike, and the attacks presumably hit facilities used by Iraq's popular mobilization units in eastern Syria.
There's not much more that I'll be able to add at this point, other than the fact that we're confident in the target that we went after. We know what we get.
Western media says the number of casualties from the U.S. airstrike is 20 people or above, but our sources suggest that the number is closer to 5, 4 injured and 1 dead. That's quite a discrepancy there. But anyways, let's check out social media's reaction to this story, as always. Our first tweet comes from this user with the unpronounceable handle. He wrote, "So people are just going to forget that Trump bombed people as well? Invading other countries has always been on the government agenda. How do you think this country started? Well, I would imagine not through offerings of olive branches." And this picture is pretty interesting, too. It shows the exact same policies, the exact same foreign policies, rather, in all of these different administrations, just under different banners, disguised under different banners. Like in this one, in Biden's office, you can see the rainbow flag, the Yes, She Can, and the Black Lives Matter banner. And in Trump's office, you can see everything is done under the Make America Great Again slogan. And our next tweet comes from SJC. They write, "As predicted, more war by the Democrats." That's great. Now, this tweet somehow contradicts with the previous tweet because it's not exactly about Republican or Democrat policies. It's about the overall foreign policy of the U.S. This next tweet comes from Akbar Shahid Ahmed. He writes, "Key Democratic senators moving one after the other to say Biden's serious strike raises concerns about presidential overreach." Now, this is a perfect example of locking the barn door after the horse is gone. The condemnations come long after the blood is shed and the damage is done. Now, let's check out a reaction to Biden's comments on Syria back in 2016 when he was the vice president. This next tweet comes from Jeanette. She wrote, "Flashback. In an interview from 2016, Biden is asked what he would do about Assad in Syria." Let's take a look.
What's interesting about this, too, to me, is the idea that you got so many people who want you to do something about Assad. First, you're smiling. You've heard it so often.
And yet when you press the elected officials, they say, well, what do you want us to do about Assad? Take him out? Is that what you want me to do? Tell me how this ends, Charlie. You know, if you're Senator Charlie Rode, tell me how it ends, Charlie.
Now, the next couple of tweets are in response to the one that I just read. This next one comes from Kitty McFeisty. They write, "Can clearly tell this is not the same man parading around as Biden today." And the next one coming from Bamboo Bam, they write, "Humanity and Biden in the same sentence? Biden has been a key figure in all past unnecessary wars, dating back 30 years. You want to talk about humanity?
The last thing we need is another war in the Middle East.
Touche. And the military strike comes at a time when Americans are struggling to cope financially with the pandemic. And just to make matters worse, the Senate Democrats failed to raise the minimum wage to $15. Remember the campaign? Yeah, that didn't happen. Our next tweet comes from Gravel Institute. They write, "On the 36th day of his presidency, Joe Biden bombed Syria, gave up on a $15 minimum wage, and didn't send out survival checks to the millions of people going hungry." Yeah, it's all about the campaign promises, right? And the next one coming from Kate Aronoff. She writes, "Personally, I think it should be easier to raise the minimum wage than to drop bombs on Syria." Well, that's all we had for today's edition of Hashtag Trending. Let's get back to the studio. But until the next edition, that's it for me. Take care and bye-bye.
And welcome back, everyone. The U.S. President says his administration will make an announcement next week on Saudi Arabia over the murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi.
You'll see there'll be announcements on Monday of what we're going to be doing with Saudi Arabia generally.
Biden did not provide any details about the upcoming announcement. A U.S. intelligence report has confirmed Saudi Arabia's crown prince and de facto ruler, Mohammed bin Salman, was directly responsible for Khashoggi's murder. But Washington has failed to take concrete action to bring him to justice.
The U.S. has finally released a long-awaited report on the gruesome murder of Jamal Khashoggi, confirming that the Crown Prince had personally approved an operation to capture or kill him. Accordingly, the U.S. says it has imposed sanctions against Saudi Arabia over the murder. However, Washington's restrictions only target members of the Saudi Royal Guard's Rapid Intervention Force, not their patron and commander, Mohammed bin Salman. That once again exposes Washington's double standard in dealing with criminals, despite its own intelligence assessment that Khashoggi was killed and his body dismembered at the behest of bin Salman in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in 2018. The UN has reacted to the CIA report, saying the U.S. fails to take practical steps to hold the main culprit accountable.
With the release of the U.S. report confirming Saudi officials' culpability at the highest levels, the United States should now take the lead in ensuring accountability for this crime and for setting in place the international mechanisms to prevent and punish such acts in the future. The United States government should impose sanctions against the Crown Prince as it has done for the other perpetrators, targeting his personal assets but also his international engagements.
Reactions are also pouring in from other authorities and legal experts who have dismissed the U.S. report as too little, too late.
This is not enough. The Crown Prince needs to face accountability. He needs to face sanctions, asset freezes, travel bans.
Analysts are also criticizing the White House for failing to take the Saudi Crown Prince to account.
Nobody saw the actual report until now. And yes, it's confirmed that indeed, as the Saudis say, a rogue operative was responsible. And that rogue is bin Salman himself.
Many believe Washington's failure to hold bin Salman accountable is due to its interests. Even the U.S. itself has admitted that it is seeking its own interests in maintaining a close partnership with Riyadh.
I would say the relationship with Saudi Arabia is an important one. We have significant ongoing interests. We remain committed to the defense of the kingdom. And so what we've done by the actions that we've taken is really not to rupture the relationship, but to recalibrate it.
In fact, decades-old U.S.-Saudi nexus have benefited the both, with Riyadh spending its petrodollars for American arms and Washington hatching plots to destabilize the region for its own sake. The U.S. backing for the Saudi regime's deadly mayhem in Yemen over the past 5 years is part of such plots. If the new U.S. administration claims that it really wants to break with the policies of the Trump government, it should walk the walk rather than talk the talk and stop supporting the al-Saud regime that has a long history of malign disregard for not only its own citizens like Khashoggi, but even the impoverished people like Yemenis.
The United Nations says thousands of Yemeni civilians have been displaced amid intensified clashes between Saudi-backed forces and the Ansarullah movement in the province of Ma'arib. UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said the violence displaced over 8,000 people in the first week of February. Ma'arib, where latest clashes have occurred, already hosts some 1 million displaced civilians. According to the International Organization for Migration, some of the people in the displacement sites have been at least three times forcibly relocated. Meanwhile, dozens of troops have reportedly been killed in renewed clashes since Saturday. The Ansarullah movement says its Ma'arib offensive is aimed at protecting citizens who the UN says Saudi-backed militants are using as human shields. In Bangladesh, hundreds of people have taken part in a second day of protests in the capital, Dhaka, over the death of a prominent writer in prison. Protesters marched the University of Dhaka to condemn the government's treatment of Mushtaq Ahmed, as well as other activists. They also demanded officials scrap the Digital Security Act, under which Ahmed was detained last May. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina shrugged off criticism of her government, saying the law was taking its course. This comes after clashes broke out between demonstrators and security forces in the capital Friday night. Police said 6 people were arrested, and activists said at least 30 protesters were injured. The Myanmar military has fired the country's UN envoy after he spoke out against the February 1st coup, which ousted de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi. Myanmar state television said that Kwon Mao Toon had betrayed the country and abused the power of a permanent ambassador. On Friday, he urged the UN to use any means necessary to reverse the coup. He told the UN General Assembly that he was speaking on behalf of the ousted civilian government. Myanmar has been in turmoil since the army seized power and detained civilian officials, including Suu Kyi. Army alleged voter fraud in the November elections won by Suu Kyi's party. Anti-coup protests have continued unabated despite the military's use of force to quell the protests. European Union leaders expressed concern over the spread of COVID-19 variants within the 27-nation bloc amid criticism that vaccines are being administered too slowly. handling of the pandemic in the EU is contributing to economic uncertainty and social inequality. Jerome Hughes has your details.
Like millions of other young people in the EU, Charles Prevot feels he has not been given adequate support by authorities during the pandemic. In order to survive, the entrepreneur has purchased his own hot dog stand, which he operates in Brussels.
I was working on a restaurant. I was managing a restaurant, and I lost my job, and I was like, what I can do? What I can do next? What we can do? What the young people, the young men, the young ladies in this world, in this city, in this country, what they can do, because we don't have any help?
As businesses continue to fold in the EU and millions lose their jobs, people feel there is no hope. Only 6.4% of the bloc's population have received a vaccine. That's tiny compared to the UK and US. A two-day video conference involving EU leaders has just concluded. They are very concerned about COVID-19 mutations.
The B117 is by now in all member states but one. The South African variant is in 14 member states and the Brazilian variant in 7. So there's a lot of challenge ahead of us.
Variants are allowed to flourish when people are not vaccinated. Experts say the bureaucratic structures of the EU have resulted in citizens having to wait far too long for vaccines. However, EU leaders say producers are not keeping their promises in terms of supply.
We want more predictability and transparency to ensure that pharmaceutical companies comply with their commitments.
Health officials warn mixed messages from EU leaders about the efficacy of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine are making citizens reluctant to take the jab. Two other vaccines have been approved here, but supply remains a big problem. A fourth vaccine from Johnson & Johnson is likely to be approved next month. During their summit, EU leaders talked at length about the importance of developing certificates to show people have been vaccinated in order to open up travel. Commentators are describing this as laughable, saying it is putting the cart before the horse, given the current state of play with respect to the rollout of vaccines. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Total COVID deaths in America have surpassed 510,000 as the country is struggling with new variants of the virus. Data by Johns Hopkins University shows more than 28.4 million people have been confirmed to have contracted the disease in the U.S. The country has the largest infection and death tallies worldwide. Cases and hospitalizations have seen a downward trend since early January, and fatalities have also been declining over the past week. However, health officials have warned the declines could stall due to more infectious variants spreading now across the country. Researchers have now reported a new COVID strain which surfaced in New York City, and they say it's more resistant to some existing vaccines than earlier versions of the virus. Washington correspondent Colin Campbell says that U.S. coronavirus situation is still precarious as new daily highs remain through the roof.
The amount of people that are still getting coronavirus seems to have plateaued in many states. But the thing that comes with that plateau is some good news and bad news. Yes, it initially sounds like good news that states are not really increasing the amount of cases, new cases of people contracting COVID-19. However, where they are plateauing is at the rate before we had the holiday surge late last year in 2020. So that means that there are still escalated levels of people who still have COVID-19 and the levels that are sustaining in various states across the country. So therefore, the vaccines are continuing to roll out. There are still issues in supply chain management when it comes to delivering these vaccines because of the amount of vaccines that need to be delivered. Not only that, it needs to be done in a two-phase process. And we had weather disturbances that caused disruptions in how those vaccines were going to be administered. So right now, the United States is still in a very precarious situation.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
IRIB English Radio. Thank you. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Second phase of the revolution.
Of the revolution. Of the revolution.
Leap in production.
The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, attaches a great deal of significance to education among workers. He says, in the current world and with the speedy technological developments, constant education and training and using the previous experience is a necessity for productive and working institutions so that economic prosperity increases through strengthening of productivity and quality of production. Please stay with us with a new program in our series, Second Phase of the Revolution, Leap in Production. Stay with us. Academic studies on successful economic models show that development occurs in societies in which, in addition to natural resources and material assets, there are notable human resources too. In other words, the countries that have achieved higher economic growth have better education, better skilled workers, and a more efficient workforce. The top parameter in development of any country is its manpower, which has a remarkable share in the economic, social, and cultural development of the country. Studies on development reveal that government policies, including investment on human resource development and expenses of research and development, have not only been effective on growth and productivity, but also on appropriate distribution of income and reduction of economic inequality. In the postmodern era, human asset is the greatest and most valuable property of every organization and every country. Accordingly, investment in this field, especially in the domain of innovative sciences relating to cyberspace and artificial intelligence, is a strategic necessity due to the fact that these two factors set the ground for exponential growth of production. In view of this, many researchers and experts of management and productivity maintain that a country's access to high level of productivity depends on having organizations and factories that enjoy adequate competitiveness, profitability, and creation of high added value. To create such organizations, it is essential to have skilled workforce and productive personnel. Human asset, in fact, demonstrates the know-how in the minds and thoughts of the personnel, and it is the basic source of innovation and regeneration of an organization, introduces a combination of qualifications, attitude, and creativity of its personnel. Today, the role and importance of manpower is a yardstick in gauging production and offering services. In view of this, human asset or human personnel has gained higher share so that it has created the concept of know-how economy in production of gross domestic product or GDP. Ayatollah said that Khamenei's emphasis on LEAP in production and manufacturing during the era of maximum sanctions outlines a pleasant perspective of Iran's economy. The only way to exit from current economic woes is to fix the eyes on the interior and use the domestic capacities and capabilities in a synergy of skilled and specialist workforce. Human assets can both transform themselves and develop to modify other parameters. This will result in a permanent, dynamic economy. Alvin Toffler, a pioneer of change and development, says know-how and technology are the key to economic growth. Many countries have attained an important status in the global economy through planning and reliance on domestic resources and implementation of long-term projects based on know-how and technology. Statistics show that Iran ranks third in terms of manpower development. As for economic development, Iran has had a good economic growth, which is manifested in the fields of nanotechnology and knowledge-based companies. Development of technical and professional training plays a vital role in the current state of Iran's economy, because the country's infrastructural investment and increase of tools and equipment without an efficient human workforce will be useless or will be used ineffectively. Technical and professional training requires both development and a mix of know-how, skills, and creativity, particularly among a young workforce, the educated youth. Thus, technical and professional universities play a significant role in teaching the necessary skills for the workforce needed in industry, agriculture, and the service sector. Today, these universities have a capacity to educate nearly 150,000 students at 174 universities and higher institutions and academic centers. Targeted training of skills as a national strategy plays a key role in achieving economic success, social welfare, boosting creativity and innovation, and bringing about a leap in manufacture and production. This will pave the way for maximum use of capacities in the field of manufacture and production. Moving in this course will result in high and sustainable economic growth and will also assist in solving the problem of unemployment. As the leader of the Islamic Revolution has pointed out, we have many scientists, specialists, knowledge-based firms and innovative persons in the country, and this is amongst the most important economic infrastructure in every country. It means that the most important economic infrastructure for a country is the existence of a highly skilled and trained manpower.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids? That is, from the very beginning of the birth.
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, you are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we are going to look at some principles of upbringing children so that the audience gets a detailed description of the matter concerning how to raise their children Islamically. The main source is the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. And today we have in our studio guest speaker Sister Salma Khalfan, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program, Sister Salma.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for inviting me over.
Thank you so much for being here. So in our previous program, we had talked about how we can resolve conflicts between mother and father so that the child should be least affected by them. And you mentioned a couple of things that when you and your spouse try and empathize with each other, keep yourselves in each other's shoes, that way the child is also learning to do this. Or if you give your partner the benefit of doubt or at times agree to disagree, this way the child is also learning and it doesn't become a very uncontrolled situation. At least the child feels like, you know, it's kind of settling down. So you were telling us more about this.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Another way to tackle such kind of situation where domestic quarrels arouse and the child is, you know, watching and in between the scenario, is that always try to keep your tone in such a way that it's either neutral or it's not shouting. Okay, don't keep it loud in such a way that the child gets affected, because the loud noise is actually, even Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says in the ankar al aswat la sawt al hamir, in the Holy Quran, it's the worst sound. Even if you have to shout at somebody, like call out somebody, it's such a sound that, you know, kind of gets at you. Yeah, it makes you feel like
upset
and disappointed.
Yeah.
Why is this person shouting?
Yeah, I'm right here.
Yeah.
At times you're right there and you feel like the other one is shouting.
Yeah, exactly.
Or at times we unknowingly begin to shout and we don't realize, you know.
Or even out of excitement. It doesn't look good. It doesn't feel good either. It doesn't make a person feel good.
True.
So anything that needs to be said should be said in a low tone, and there's a very important thing here, with kindness. So sometimes, you know, clever parents will always deal criticism also with kindness.
True.
For example, if there would come a disagreement between the spouses, they would say that, look, although what you did was wrong, and, you know, you would have done it in a better way, it was not a right thing what you did, and probably our rights were taken away. Yeah. So how do you think you can resolve this? It takes a lot of courage to do that, of course, but it is solvable. So when the child also watches this, he feels secure that they're not fighting, they're discussing.
Yeah.
So, you know, he feels that it's normal to discuss like this sometimes. So, of course, such a parent would be so kind enough that in instances of kindness, they would show more kindness to each other.
Mm-hmm.
But in these kind of instances also, if they can't show kindness, the least they can do is that keep a neutral tone, right? Mm-hmm. A neutral tone. That, for example, if the father was late at home, or the father was waiting outside a mall and the mother came late, maybe 30 minutes, thinking that she can still shop.
Yeah.
And the father is getting late and maybe they decided upon a timing. So if the father gets angry and upset near the child and drives the car fast, it'll mean more harm than good, right? Rather than saying that, look, what you did was wrong. You promised me that you'd come at this time, but you came at this time. Now I've missed my maybe meeting.
And in these situations, it's very hard to control yourself. I feel like at times you want to control yourself, but you end up, you know, like getting upset. And I feel like it needs to be, you have to train yourself, you know.
Train yourself step by step. It's a process, step by step. And you know, the beautiful thing about this is that, you know, what happens is that when you speak like this, the other feels more guilty than when you shout. Because when you shout, it's like you're bursting out and the other person also can't, you know, convey the message. So they also shout back. And it's just a shouting
match.
A blast match. Yeah. So instead of talking it out and saying what you did was wrong, constructive criticism.
Yeah.
Okay. What you did was wrong. This was not the right thing to do. And you left, you know, like you took it for granted that I was supposed to reach at this place at this time.
True.
And now I've missed it. All because of your fault. And probably this will be the outcome. So the person will feel guilty and next time they won't do it. But these kind of quarrels that start with shouting and criticism is forced upon the other, then it ends up, you know, like in a very bad row. True. And the child is also mostly affected. Yeah. And he also learns to, you know, to be like this, to shout to get his way.
Exactly. So we're just going to take a short break, inshallah, and we're going to be back for more on this topic just after the break. Stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Okay, so you're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran, and this is Islamic Upbringing. So we have been talking about how we can resolve conflicts, and you have said that it is important for us to, you know, at times when there is a quarrel, we should at least try and keep our voice neutral, or we should try and speak as if we're having a discussion so that the child doesn't feel like there is something wrong or too wrong going on. They're having a discussion, or try to show each other kindness, because it really affects and helps. Yes, and you were continuing.
Yeah, it's just a little left on that. The parents should remember that they are on the same team. They are bringing the child, the same child, and the child will be affected by both of them, their attitudes. So they should be very alert at that, that they shouldn't go take their, you know, themselves, get carried away in the process of argumentation also. So they should do it first slowly, agreeably, and also request for solutions. Probably they want to find solutions, but they're quarreling. Now, what do I do? Request for solution. Please tell me what to do now.
Yeah.
You know, that is a polite tone, and that would probably less affect the child. But all in all, you know, the best thing to do is not to quarrel at all.
Yeah.
And another best thing to do would keep silent. So even if one party is quarreling, the other keeps silent, it usually neutralizes the situation in such a way that the other partner realizes his mistake. He realizes that he's done the wrong thing.
Or even if the parents go into a separate room and discuss there if possible, because if they do it out and near the child, like very openly, it's very negative.
So, and it's so negative that I've seen the parents who do that near the child, then they can't control near anybody.
It's true.
Then, you know, whether it be probably a cousin or somebody like a friend, it gets so embarrassing, but they just can't control themselves. So it's better to, you know, take it
like a controlled environment.
Yeah, control yourself before it gets out of hand. So basically, these are the steps that parents ought to be careful of, so that the child cannot be deviated, cannot go into bad habits, can feel secure, can, you know, work harder in life, can study well, can get the peace of mind.
Yeah, because a lot of children, I feel like when they don't have that peace of mind, when they're not feeling that tranquility at home, then when they grow up, when they go outside, they'll try and find it elsewhere, because they want this settled area, environment. And if they can't find it at home, which is supposed to be the ideal place, then it's very unfortunate.
That's right, absolutely. And then you see them, you know, having bad friends and juvenile delinquency in their youth. Things
very
like
true.
That. So.
So we're just going to take a short break, inshallah, and we'll continue for more on this after the break. Audience, please stay tuned.
A man came to the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam and said, "O Messenger of Allah, my family makes me angry. How should I punish them?" He said, "Forgive them." Narrated in the book Al-Mu'jam al-Kabir, second volume, page 269.
So welcome back, your audience, to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran, and this is Islamic Upbringing. So we have been talking about how to resolve conflicts between parents, and how we can make the situations better so that the child doesn't get affected badly. Yeah. And you had something more to tell us.
Yeah, last but not least, I'd like to add this, that this is very important, of course. It goes back to the roots of the problem.
Yeah.
Before even the spouse begin to have children, they should think about this, that how would they deal with their conflicts in front of the child, or try to solve their conflicts completely.
True.
So because they are in the same team, right? So they should be very careful on that. So also
they should like work on themselves, see yes. how if it's going over like overboard or out of hand, and they should see, okay, now when we get children, we should make sure that this shouldn't happen over there. So let's try, and if we have conflicts, then let's try and do it in a way that it doesn't go over the limit.
Extreme, yeah.
Yeah.
And normally, you know, when the conflicts are so extreme, it's because the beliefs are so extreme. So we in Islam have one belief, right? We have faith in Allah. We have, for example, faith in the Holy Prophet as the messenger of Allah and the 14 infallible Imams, the Day of Judgment. All these things are so similar between the spouses if they choose, they select the right spouse.
True.
So, of course, this will be like a very big asset for them to deal with the child on how to deal with the quarrels
exactly.
you know, between themselves.
Because why do these quarrels happen? Because a small misunderstanding, then at times the spouse feels like, okay, they want the other spouse to understand what they're going through, so they feel like, okay, they want to make a big deal about it. But it's so easy to resolve it if they, you know, discuss about it, if they try and think, if before doing this, they should, you know, try and read more about
this. And they
this.
Have faith, of course. The faith helps, you know, it's a very big asset.
Yeah,
the
whatever you do
have
for
faith,
the sake
they'll
of
have
God.
Patience.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
So this similarity is in the belief. And then other things, of course, and nobody thinks the same way completely. So in different things, they might have different opinions. But as far as the main goal is concerned, that is to believe in Allah, to have faith in Allah, to have patience, to, you know, to believe in the Holy Prophet, ask from the Holy Prophet. So these all things will help them resolve their fights in a very amicable way, all
very
in all.
Yeah. And when you look at role models like the way Hazrat Zahra and Imam Ali were, you feel like you want to, you know, be like them and emulate their relationship, you know, and inshallah that everybody is able to do that. Sure. Then we feel like there is a possibility that couples don't fight, they can resolve their differences, they can, you know, work together and be a source of comfort for each other, inshallah.
And it's a slow process. Perfection is a slow process, step by step. So the main thing is to keep a strong will and to not lose hope. When you don't lose hope, then you'll know that there is still an outlet to try again. To, you know, talk to the child, to explain it. Sometimes we have difference of opinions. If we have gone too far and you don't want the child to be abroad badly, so if you can explain to the child, if he's a bit old enough to understand, that these things happened but we were wrong about it. Next time we'll try to be careful, more careful. You know, we don't want to do that. Allah is not happy even if you do it in future. Without keeping yourself low and, you know, feel, intimidated near the child. No, you have to be very smart and strong and have the upper hand.
Yeah.
But at the same time, explain the child about these things if it has gone too far ahead. So the child will be less affected. At least he won't feel insecure. He'll feel that they admitted their mistakes. So it's like something that is solvable.
Yeah, exactly. That's very true. Very true. Thank you very much. I feel like this was a very effective discussion. Inshallah, that parents are going to be able to learn from this and that their relationships can even get better. Inshallah. Dear audience, thank you very much for joining us on the program. If you have any questions, comments or suggestions, please contact us at our email englishradio@irib.ir and visit us at our website parstoday.com. Inshallah, until the next program, fi amanillah and God bless you all.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. The sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
the limelight.
Iran has condemned as a flagrant violation of human rights and international law the illegal and aggressive attacks by American terrorist forces on various regions of eastern Syria. In a statement on Friday night, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Saeed Khatibzadeh, stressed that such attacks against Syria were a continuation of the Israeli regime's unabated aggression against the Arab country. We now present you an article written by staff writers of Press TV's website. The piece is titled, Bad Sign from Biden Administration, Syria Slams Fatal U.S. Raid on Iraq Border. Please stay with us for more. The government in Damascus has censured the United States' air raid against positions of Iraqi counterterrorism forces on the Iraq-Syria border, which martyred one and wounded four others, describing it as a bad sign from the administration of new U.S. President Joe Biden. In a statement by Syria's official Sana'a News Agency on Friday, 26th of February, the Syrian Foreign Ministry said, Syria strongly condemns the American act of aggression in the early hours of the day on facilities used by forces of Iraq's Popular Mobilization Units, PMUs, better known as Hashd al-Shaabi, at a border point in Syria's eastern Deir al-Zor province. The statement said, in a flagrant violation of the rules of international law and Charter of the United Nations, U.S. warplanes on Thursday, 25th of February, launched a cowardly aggression by bombing some areas in Deir al-Zor province near the Syria-Iraq border. The statement added, it is a bad sign regarding the policies of the new U.S. administration, which should adhere to international laws and norms. The military action, the first of its kind under U.S. President Joe Biden, has been met with a negative reaction, with many observers likening Biden's approach to that of his hawkish predecessor Donald Trump. Iraqi resistance forces have been fighting remnants of the Takfiri Daesh terrorist group across border regions of Iraq and Syria in coordination with the government in Damascus. An informed source said that one person had lost his life and four others had been injured in the U.S. military's act of aggression. In a statement issued after the attack, Pentagon spokesman John Kirby said the raid authorized by President Biden had been deliberate and meant to de-escalate the overall situation in both eastern Syria and in Iraq. America's defense secretary also thanked Baghdad for helping with what he called intelligence input in a claim that surprised the Iraqi government. The Iraqi defense ministry denied the claim in a statement and said Baghdad's cooperation with U.S.-led military coalition is restricted to fighting terrorism and averting threats against Iraq in a way that the country's sovereignty and territorial integrity would remain unharmed. Military action was said to be in retaliation for recent attacks against American bases and American military forces in Iraq, which Washington has blamed on Iraqi resistance groups. In the later such attacks, rockets hit Baghdad's Green Zone, which houses the U.S. Embassy and other missions recently. The American military base in Erbil had similarly been attacked just days earlier. However, the Iraqi resistance groups and many Iraqi officials have roundly dismissed Washington's allegations, blaming rogue elements for the attack. There has been a sharp rise in attacks on U.S. military bases and diplomatic missions in Iraq since early last year, after the Iraqi parliament passed a law urging the withdrawal of all U.S. occupying forces from Iraq. Amid widespread anger over Washington's assassination of top Iranian anti-terrorist commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, and the deputy commander of the Popular Mobilization Units of Iraq, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandes. The Americans tried to link the raids on their positions to Tehran's pledge to extract revenge for Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani's murder. However, the Islamic Republic says it will not hide its act of revenge whenever it decides to go for it, just like what it did in the case of the retaliatory missile raid on the U.S.-run Ain al-Assad Air Base in western Iraq. Analysts say the attacks on U.S. positions in Iraq, which usually cause almost no damage to the targets, are meant to serve as a pretext for the U.S. to keep its terrorist forces in the country. In turn, Faisal Ahmad, the head of the Syrian Parliament's Committee on National Security, strongly condemned the U.S. airstrikes, which targeted positions of the Syrian army and its allied forces. The senior Syrian lawmaker told Iran's Tasnim news agency, "What just happened is highly dangerous. Washington is keeping up its act of aggression to advance the interests of the regime in occupied Palestine." The senior Syrian lawmaker, Faisal Ahmad, added, "The attack will not undermine the iron resolve of Syria and its allies to drive American occupiers out of Syrian soil, but will rather strengthen the Syrian nation's determination to strengthen its role in the resistance actis and to confront Western and global arrogance." Thursday, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif spoke to his Syrian counterpart, Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad, on the telephone. The two officials emphasized the need for Western countries to abide by UN Security Council resolutions regarding Syria. The Iranian Foreign Minister Zarif reaffirmed Iran's support for the Syrian nation in its effort to rid the country of terrorist groups, many of which have the support of US military in their campaign of destruction. Meanwhile, the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, an ally of Syria, said on Friday, 26 February, that the United States had notified Moscow of the impending attack on the Popular Mobilization Unit facility 4 or 5 minutes ahead of the actual attack. Sergei Lavrov said, "Our military was warned 4 or 5 minutes ahead of time. Of course, even if we are talking about deconfliction, as is customary in ties between Russia and U.S. military personnel, this is nothing. This was a kind of notification where the strike was already being carried out." The Russian foreign minister said the U.S. military is present on Syrian soil illegally in violation of all norms of international law, including Security Council resolutions on reconciliation in Syria. He said Russia had received unconfirmed information that the U.S. is planning to stay in Syria indefinitely. Sergei Lavrov added, "We have recently received various information from various sources. We cannot confirm it for now and want to ask the Americans about this directly. Supposedly, they are making the decision to never leave Syria, even to the point of destroying the country." The Russian Foreign Ministry under Lavrov also condemned the U.S. airstrike, urging the Americans to respect Syria's territorial integrity. The Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova told reporters, "We strongly condemn such actions and call for Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity to be unconditionally respected." Meanwhile, the Chinese Foreign Ministry also reacted to the U.S. airstrikes, warning against any action that will further complicate the situation in the Middle East. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman, Wang Wenbin, at a press briefing on Friday, 26th of February, said, China calls on all relevant parties to respect Syria's sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity. The United States began its military intervention in Syria with the emergence of the Daesh terrorist group in 2014, when Washington and its allies formed a military coalition under the pretext of fighting the terrorist group. In parallel, Washington also deployed its own military forces and equipment in Syria as part of its unilateral so-called anti-terror campaign. The U.S. and its allies did nothing to uproot Daesh terrorists and even worked hand-in-hand with Daesh terrorists on occasions to hinder Syrian army operations, which were backed by both Iran and Russia, against the terrorist group. Daesh terrorists suffered defeat in Syria in late 2017, but the United States refused to end its unlawful military presence in the country, which has neither a United Nations authorization nor the consent of the government in Damascus. Washington even began to strengthen its foothold in eastern Syria and northeastern parts of the country, which is rich in oil. The Deir al-Zour province in Syria, where a large part of Syria's oil reserves are located, currently hosts America's most notorious military base in the Arab country, which is widely reported to be used by Washington to train the remnants of the Daesh terrorist group and various other terrorist outfits operating against the Syrian government. The U.S.-controlled region also serves as a safe route for Daesh terrorists to freely move across the border from Syria into neighboring Iraq and vice versa. Russia once said the Tanf region of eastern Syria had become a black hole, which Daesh terrorists used to carry out attacks against Syrian government forces and Syrian civilians.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.